Mike Burke, Dina Gozder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresina, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler fires the officer who leaked false accusations against Commissioner Hardesty. Biden gave his first State of the Union address last night, and in international news, the United Nations takes action against Russian aggression in Ukraine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 2nd, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Mayor Ted Wheeler fired former police union president Brian Hunziker nearly 1 year after he leaked a report that falsely identified City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty as the suspect in a hit-and-run crash. In the termination letter, Wheeler wrote, quote, "While you did not agree that your actions were retaliatory, based upon the information and statements contained in the record, I find that your actions violated the retaliation policy because of your admission in the investigation that you were motivated in part because of Commissioner Hardesty's comments about the police during the 2020 protests." Police Chief Chuck Lavelle had recommended giving Hunziker a 12-week suspension without pay, but in an email, Wheeler wrote, quote, "With all respect to you as the chief, I cannot support a suspension in this case due to the harm caused by his conduct and the egregiousness of his actions." Wheeler also apologized to Hardesty on behalf of the police bureau. Hunziker leaked the information almost a year ago on March 4th, 2021, and a police investigation began the day after, but only recently concluded. Hunziker is also a defendant in a $5 million civil lawsuit filed by Hardesty in December, which seeks $3 million from the Portland Police Association and $1 million each from Hunziker and Officer Carrie Ottoman, who was also involved in the leak. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler issued his third emergency order on homelessness of 2022 today. This time, he wants to put all of the various city departments that deal with the crisis under one roof, a new Street Services Coordination Center. The plan has been in the works since the fall, and Wheeler said the city's complicated bureaucracy is a major block in solving the problem and meeting people's needs. For example, the staff in charge of coordinating sweeps is in a different bureau to the fire department that is sometimes called to help with fires at campsites as campers try to stay warm. Park rangers are in an entirely separate bureau from parking enforcement, which is also different from the City-County Partnership, the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Workers in these various departments will report to the Street Services Coordination Center for the parts of their job that relate to Untown's Portlanders, and the rest of their job reporting will stay within their current bureau. Wheeler says he hopes to have accurate daily assessments of how many shelter beds are available and where they are by this summer. He's also looking for funding from the city to offer rides to folks to get to a shelter free of charge. Since the new hub pulls reporting and authority away from existing bureaus, it also takes the oversight away from various city councilors. Mayor Wheeler's emergency order will put the oversight of responding to the city's homelessness crisis under his control. President Biden gave his first State of the Union address last night. With that story and more, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
When the history of this era is written, Putin's war in Ukraine will have left Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger.
Facing pressing issues at home and abroad, President Joe Biden delivered his first State of the Union address Tuesday evening. In the speech, the president announced several new tactics to curb the Russian invasion of Ukraine, including a plan to close off U.S. airspace to all Russian flights.
Throughout our history, we've learned this lesson. When dictators do not pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos.
Biden also highlighted several infrastructure projects he says will stimulate the economy, including an initiative to repair more than 65,000 miles of highway and install 500,000 electric vehicle chargers across the country.
Just look around and you'll see an amazing story. The rebirth of pride that comes from stamping products made in America. The revitalization of American manufacturing. Companies are choosing to build new factories here when just a few years ago they would have gone overseas.
Prior to Biden's address, the House debated a measure that would expand health care coverage for armed services members who have been exposed to toxic substances. The $282 billion proposal would link 23 different illnesses to chemicals used in warfare, permitting folks who live with those illnesses to receive veterans benefits. Texas Democrat Al Green said the bill is a critical measure to support returning veterans.
The greatness of America will be measured by what kind of housing do we give them? Do we help them to transition from military life to a job in civilian life? The greatness of America will be measured by the kind of insurance that they get so that they can have the best health care the world can afford.
The leader of a partisan review into Wisconsin's November 2020 presidential election has endorsed decertifying the state's results. Biden won the key swing state by a margin of more than 20,000 votes, a win that since has been reaffirmed by partial recounts in two of the state's most populous counties. Michael Gableman, the investigation's leader and a former state Supreme Court justice, told a legislative committee the recommendations outlined in an interim investigation report issued Tuesday would help ensure the security of future elections.
When I started this process, when I started this whole procedure, I had no other goal in mind than to find the truth. And while we don't have it entirely yet, we're getting there.
Nonpartisan attorneys in the state's legislature have said overturning the election results is illegal, and the proposal has been rejected by the state's Republican leadership. Finally, the White House will put out its roadmap for the next phase of the pandemic this morning. The administration says the plan will offer a path to loosening COVID-19 restrictions as case rates continue to drop from the Omicron surge earlier this year. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Senate Republicans blocked a bill that would have solidified the right to an abortion after the House passed it on a party line vote. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
Republicans blocked the U.S. Senate from considering the Women's Health Protection Act after the House previously passed it on a party line vote. Democrats fell 14 votes short of the 60 needed to bring the act to the floor. One Democrat, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, joined all Republicans in opposition to beginning the debate. The measure would codify in federal law abortion rights that have been protected by the 1973 Roe v. Wade court ruling. It was desired by Democrats and abortion rights groups as a way to counter the increasingly severe abortion restrictions being enacted at the state level. Legislators said this was the first time that the Senate had voted on a separate bill to enact the constitutional protections of Roe v. Wade into actual law. The conservative-dominated Supreme Court is also set to rule later this year on a case that could overturn the landmark abortion decision. Some two dozen states have prepared legislation that would immediately restrict abortion rights if the court upholds a Mississippi law which bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Roe, in subsequent decisions, allowed abortions about 2 months later. Democrats say the measure is needed to guarantee that women around the nation have equal access to abortion and to prevent states from imposing restrictions that are not medically necessary as a way to unconstitutionally prevent abortions. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader, called this a dark, dark time for abortion rights in the United States. He said, quote, "Abortion has never been more at risk in America," end quote. Abortion rights opponents say the proposed legislation would allow late-term abortions and eliminate state abortion restrictions with strong public support. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, criticized Democrats for holding a show vote when there were more pressing issues such as the conflict in Ukraine to consider. He predicted the maneuver would backfire on Democrats. The outcome was anticipated, but Democrats wanted to hold the vote, as abortion rights are expected to be a major election year issue in November. Democrats say that a court decision striking down Roe, plus the spread of new abortion restrictions around the nation, could rally women voters in their favor. Experts believe Monday's vote was aimed at getting Republicans on the record. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Patients in Texas and other states that restrict abortions are finding creative ways to get abortion pills online. The Supreme Court let the Texas 6-week abortion ban stand, and a decision looms on a Mississippi 15-week abortion ban that could overturn Roe v. Wade. Lily Bolke has more.
With the Supreme Court allowing the Texas 6-week abortion ban to stand and another decision looming that may overturn Roe v. Wade, Texans are finding creative ways to obtain abortion pills online. The FDA recently removed the long-standing restriction on mailing mifepristone, which opened up the opportunity for clinicians in 24 states and D.C. to provide abortion pills by telemedicine and mail. Texas is not one of them, but Elisa Wells with Plan C says many Texans and people in other restrictive states are ordering pills directly from online pharmacies in other countries, going through an Austrian healthcare provider called Aid Access, or using mail forwarding services to get pills from a state where telehealth abortions are legal.
We've included a section on our website about creative ways people are accessing pills when they live in restricted areas to help people understand what we know people are doing and how to do it.
Plan C tested out online pharmacies that sell mifepristone and misoprostol, and their website lists sites that reliably ship the pills, the cost, and the time it took to arrive. If patients choose to go through Aid Access, they will have a physician-supervised telemedicine appointment through an online form, and then the pills are shipped from India, which can take several weeks. Wells notes Plan C also tested out mail forwarding and found it does work. People rent an address in a state that allows telehealth abortions from services such as iPostal1.com or Anytime Mailbox, do an online consultation with a licensed provider, and get the pills shipped to their rented address and then forwarded to them at home.
You have to jump through a few hoops. You have to provide certain forms of ID, and you have to have an electronic notarization done. It's all online. You don't have to go anywhere. You just have to upload some documents, and you have to pay some fees.
She says some people, alternatively, will ask a friend in a legal state to use their address or use general delivery at a post office and go there to pick it up themselves. If they use the post office, it's important to make sure their ID matches the name on the package. Wells says despite these creative ways to access abortion pills, the fact that they're not available everywhere shows that the system is broken.
We have modern, mainstream, 21st century abortion available by telehealth with safe and effective pills so that people can manage their own abortion in the privacy of their own home in more than 20 states. There's no reason why somebody shouldn't be able to do a telehealth consult with any doctor they want in this country that's willing to serve them and receive the pills by mail.
Wells says if patients have any questions about potential legal risks, they can call the free ReProLegal Legal Helpline at 844-868-2812. This story was produced with original reporting by Carrie Baker of Ms. Magazine. This is Lily Bolke with Texas News Service.
Depression and thoughts of suicide are higher among transgender youth, but studies show that gender-affirming care improves their mental health. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Transgender youth face increased risks of depression and suicide compared with other young people, but the latest study finds gender-affirming care helps reduce those risks. University of Washington epidemiologist Diana Tordoff says medication like puberty blockers has been used for more than 30 years, and not just by trans youth. Similarly, she says gender-affirming hormone therapy like testosterone or estrogen is nothing new and helps a young person experience puberty properly aligned with their gender. In her study, Tordoff followed more than 100 trans youth between the ages of 13 and 20 over the course of a year.
The main findings of our study is that youth who received puberty blockers or gender-affirming hormones were 60% less likely to be depressed and 73% less likely to have suicidal thoughts compared to youth who did not receive those medications.
Tordoff says the results aren't surprising, and this is just the most recent research to show gender-affirming care improves mental health for trans youth. She adds other studies have found the positive impacts can last into adulthood. The UW study was done in collaboration with the Seattle Children's Hospital Gender Clinic. Tordoff says anti-trans discrimination and stigma has effects on people's mental health. That includes inaccurate portrayals in the media and a record-breaking slate of recent legislation targeting trans people across the country. But she also notes trans youth can thrive when they are supported by their families and communities.
What we keep saying over and over again, because it's true, is that gender-affirming care is life-saving care, and it's also life-giving care. It really allows people to thrive and live their best lives as their most authentic selves.
She lists many barriers to getting that care, including financial and geographical, plus insurance coverage and long wait times to see pediatric providers. She adds only 1 in 5 young people who could benefit from gender-affirming hormones access them. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the music director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, whose winter concert is coming up on Saturday, March 5th. Stick around at 6, we'll hear Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, the rain showers do take a break, with an overnight low of 49 degrees, and then tomorrow those clouds continue with a high of 50. Today in history, in 1937, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee signed a collective bargaining agreement with U.S. Steel, leading to the unionization of the American steel industry. The quote of the day is from American science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. He wrote, quote, "Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away." Today, the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly approved a resolution demanding that Russia stop the war in Ukraine and withdraw all troops. The resolution had 141 votes pro, 5 against, and 3 abstentions. Russian troop activity continues to increase, surrounding Kiev, where the major TV station and central rail station have been struck by explosives. Russian paratroopers landed in Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, after several days of bombardment that killed or wounded dozens of civilians. Major battles continue in the important port cities of Kherson and Mariupol. A Ukrainian delegation is now on its way to meet with a Russian delegation in Belarus. Nearly 850,000 Ukrainians, mostly women and children, have fled the country since the Russian attack began, with over a third going to Poland. The UN has projected that the number of refugees could exceed 4 million. The European Union has granted Ukrainian refugees the right to live and work in the EU for 3 years. Much of the international focus is currently on the Ukraine and Russia conflict, but less attention has been paid to the missile test done in North Korea in January. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Thanks, and hello, everybody. North Korea's Kim Jong-un knows how to take advantage of a world in turmoil. North Korea's 7th missile test in January, a record number, almost certainly was timed to events in the United States and South Korea, and maybe in China and Russia, too. The U.S., NATO, and Russia are embroiled in confrontation over Ukraine. South Korea will have a presidential election in March. China is walking a tightrope on Ukraine and is dealing with a resurgence of the pandemic in Hong Kong. All these events preoccupy national leaders who probably have in common the wish that the North Koreans would somehow go away. Close observers of the North Korean tests see a familiar pattern. They test increasingly long-range and powerful missiles, await strong reactions from Washington, Seoul, and Tokyo, and then go into negotiation mode. The latest test on January 29 was an intermediate-range missile, whereas previous ones were shorter range. Upcoming tests might, as in the past, include an ICBM that could, in theory, reach the U.S. All these tests violate U.N. prohibitions, but sanctions have not persuaded North Korea to stop. North Korea has refrained from violating its own moratorium, which Kim Jong-un announced in 2018, on long-range ballistic missile and nuclear tests. But missile production continues. Why is that? One reason is national unity at a time when the economy is a mess, as Kim Jong-un has admitted. As Kim emphasized in his New Year's message, increasing food production is the top priority. A U.S. government estimate is 63% of the North Korean population is food insecure. Missile tests, to the contrary, are a great success and a source of national, or at least the elite's, pride. Under Kim, North Korea has conducted over 130 missile tests and four of the North's total of six nuclear tests. Second, Kim needs to get America's attention, reminding Washington of its military capability. Not, mind you, its intention. It most certainly is not threatening a missile strike anywhere. But it wants the U.S. to pay attention to its needs, both strategic and economic. That means reducing what it perceives to be the ongoing U.S.-South Korean threat and the sanctions. The Trump administration's main failure in talks with North Korea was its refusal to offer incentives to denuclearize. Trump walked away from his summits with Kim with nothing more than photo ops. Biden has proposed talks without preconditions, which is fine, but without incentives as well, he's not going to get anywhere. The standard U.S. policy of demanding denuclearization first and only then talking about ending sanctions has never worked and won't work now. But with so many other domestic and international issues on his plate, Biden has given North Korea very low priority. One option that has always been on the U.S. president's table is to seek China's help. The rationale is simple. China has always fretted about the potential for another war on its doorstep, provoked by North Korea, and China's food and fuel assistance is critical to the North Korean economy. The latest round of North Korean missile tests no doubt is causing concern in Beijing. Trouble is, China is not going to come to Washington's assistance when relations with the U.S. are at such a low point. To the contrary, China has largely ignored United Nations sanctions on fuel and other aid to North Korea because the Kim regime's survival is an important Chinese interest. Right now, Beijing has the best of both Korean worlds, good relations with North and South, and thus little reason to put pressure on the North. This year, China and South Korea are celebrating 30 years of diplomatic relations that have included substantial trade, tourism, and military exchanges. At the most recent get-together of senior diplomats, Chinese and South Korean, in December, the Chinese official affirmed that, quote, China always supports the improvement of South-North relations on the Korean Peninsula and advocates the settlement of the Korean Peninsula issue through dialogue and consultation. That sort of statement suggests that the South Koreans have won qualified support from China for the goal of ending the Korean War in tandem with North Korean reduction of missile tests. U.S. policy should be reducing sanctions in synchrony with a North Korean moratorium on its missile tests. That would mean adopting a step-by-step, action-for-action approach to the nuclear issue, as the U.S., both Koreas, China, Russia, and Japan all agreed back in 2005. And the U.S. should follow South Korea's lead, let's remember it's their country, on trying to finally end the Korean War and build cooperative projects with North Korea. The last thing Joe Biden needs as he deals with Russia is to be blindsided by another North Korean ICBM or nuclear test. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael hates war and greed.
War. What is it good for? Corporation profit. Say it again. Several countries are sending weapons to Ukraine, and who do they buy those weapons from? The oil and gas lobby say we must drill and pipeline our way to energy security, while war with the world's third largest petrostate gives U.S. the Saudis et al. An excuse for soaring prices and profits. And what's more patriotic, old Trump publicans, than to wish success to your country's enemy and failure on our, but not all of yours, president? And don't wonder who's profiting from the demise of government that tries occasionally to serve the public good instead of just a capitalist aristocracy. Peace begins inside yourself, among your close twos. Peace won't be given a chance. We must take chances for peace, persistent and patient, bold when needed, compassionate always. Makes me want to holler the way they do, my life. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A new report from the United Nations shows many coastal communities are at increased risk of severe flooding without action to address greenhouse gas emissions. An analysis shows Build Back Better could get the United States on track. Emily Scott has more on that story in New York.
A new analysis shows that clean energy investments from the Build Back Better Act would put the country on track to meet carbon emissions reduction goals. Compiled by Princeton University's Zero Lab, the report reveals that enacting the climate provisions of the $1 trillion package would cut emissions by an accumulative 5.2 billion tons between now and 2030. Report co-author Jesse Jenkins says federal policy action is needed to meet these climate targets.
In addition to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, the set of energy investment and jobs proposals in the Build Back Better Act would also lower U.S. annual energy expenditures, helping to fight or counteract inflationary forces that are driving up costs for households and businesses across the United States.
The Princeton report also finds that Build Back Better would reduce household energy costs for New Yorkers by $100 annually. The future of the bill remains in peril as some Senate lawmakers say it's too ambitious and have criticized provisions such as paid family leave because of their cost. Shannon Hike Williams of the National Wildlife Federation says, combined with the recently passed bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Build Back Better Act would help get the country close to its mid-century climate goals and help prevent the global environmental threats researchers warn about in the UN report.
They're essential, supported by the public, and would leverage infrastructure bill spending to get innovative technologies to market, restore ecosystems that boost resilience and suck up carbon, clean up legacy pollution, and position the U.S. for global competitiveness in the zero carbon economy.
The New York Climate Action Council recently released a draft scoping plan to help the state meet its greenhouse gas emissions reduction goal. Some measures include increasing the use of public transportation and electrifying heating pumps. Residents have 120 days from January 1st to submit public comments. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection.
The 2022 primary election season began yesterday in Texas with two victories for progressive Democrats and a disappointment for a major Trump supporter. Nine-time U.S. Representative Henry Cuellar, a conservative anti-abortion Democrat, failed to get 50% of the vote, so he'll face off with progressive Jessica Cisneros in a runoff in May. Former Austin City Council member and Democratic Socialist Greg Cesar, who was endorsed by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, had over 61% of the vote in a strongly Democratic 35th district. Trump endorsed Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton, responsible for Texas's new restrictive voting rules, will face George P. Bush, nephew of former President George W. Bush, in a May runoff. Republican Governor Greg Abbott handily won his primary and will face Democrat Beto O'Rourke, who almost defeated Senator Ted Cruz in 2018. In this first election under Texas's new voting rules, technical issues caused problems in Texas's largest county, Harris, while several voting sites around Houston were short-staffed. The new law is blamed for several thousand rejected mail ballots, including over 10,000 in the Houston area. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 2nd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Dan Raphael, Mel Gertov, and Ken Jones. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Jonah Chester, Emily Scott, and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be interviewing the music director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, whose winter concert is coming up on Saturday, March 5th. Stay with us.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On today's News in Depth, we preview Portland Youth Philharmonic's upcoming Russian Winter Concert with guests David Hattner, PYP's musical director, and Michael Gu, winner of the Portland Piano International 2021 Piano Concerto Competition. David programmed the concert over a year ago with works by Russian composers Sergei Prokofiev and Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, along with an opening piece from American composer William Grant Still. The Russian invasion of Ukraine cast the concert theme in a different light than David intended, but the music itself transcends politics and national borders. We'll talk about the concert in view of recent events, the program and why David chose these works, and Michael's attraction to and mastery Prokofiev's piano concerto.